We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting out with local and the Department of Justice in town.
Yes, the Department of Justice announced this week that they were launching a preliminary review of the Seattle Police Department. Notice it's not an actual investigation. They're just doing a quote-unquote preliminary review.
They're sniffing around.
Yes, they're trying to decide whether or not, still trying to decide whether or not to do a full-blown investigation. But a couple of attorneys from the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division will visit Seattle in early February and look at whether or not there should be a deeper investigation. As if on cue, on Thursday, the Seattle Times announced that the Seattle Police Department had withheld documents from a public disclosure request that the newspaper filed shortly after the Williams shooting. Apparently, City Council member Tim Burgess, who heads up the City Council Public Safety Committee, had sent an email right after the shooting to Police Chief John Diaz, who was, I believe, at the time interim chief about the shooting, saying, well, you should have an outside organization take a look at this and reassure the public that nothing has really gone wrong and that there wasn't any misconduct on the part of the police officer, blah, 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 blah. But apparently, in fulfilling a public records request, the Seattle Police Department appears to feel that the email of the police chief is off limits. Initially, when the Seattle Times filed their request for document disclosure, the Seattle Police Department rejected it out of hand and said, no, we are not a public agency that has to respond to this sort of thing.
We're not a public agency? Really?
I don't know if they actually used those words, but that was the attitude, was, we don't have to disclose documents, you know, because we're not subject to public disclosure law. And then the Seattle Times went to the city attorney's office, and City Attorney Pete Holmes then sat down and met with Chief Diaz and with the mayor. And the same day, the SPD then decided that, oh, yes, okay, we'll release these documents. Unfortunately, they didn't even mention the existence of any email between Tim Burgess and the police chief. And according to state law, the public disclosure law, you have to, even if you don't release certain documents, you have to at least mention that they exist, and they didn't do that.
Yeah, the cover-up is always worse than the crime.
Yeah, and I should note, too, that last year, the John McKay and his brothers, I believe his name is Tom McKay, two former U.S. attorneys, sued and won $70,000 judgment against the Seattle Police Department for withholding documents for one of their clients' cases. So this is a pattern of misconduct here,
yeah,
that I think the Department of Justice should be looking at.
The same McKays that have since called for the Department of Justice to launch an investigation,
yes,
of the Seattle Police Department for,
yes,
human rights violations,
mm-hmm,
civil rights violations.
All right. Moving on, big brouhaha over increase in parking rates here in Seattle.
Yeah, no, there have been headlines that the local business community is unhappy because the city wants to increase parking rates downtown and in Pioneer Square, et cetera. The city wants to raise rates for two reasons. First, it would increase revenue for the transportation budget. And of course, McGinn cites that by raising parking rates, fewer people drive, therefore you have fewer auto emissions, and both of those are good goals. I don't believe that taxing the use of personal automobiles is a bad thing. I think it's necessary, given the amount of money we spend on the infrastructure for personal automobiles. You know, roads and bridges and signal lights, all that's expensive. So increasing taxes on the use of personal autos is not bad. What I am concerned with is the fairness of a parking tax. We've talked before about how if you're going to tax people for using their cars, you have to provide an alternative. And the county and city have been particularly bad at increasing bus service, especially within the city of Seattle itself. But also, I think looking at the spread of the rates and the increase of rates on certain neighborhoods and not others is an issue in all this that the Seattle Times and the local media has completely forgotten. I looked at the list of neighborhoods where the rates are being increased, and I just laughed because here you have the one neighborhood south of the Ship Canal who is getting a decrease in rates. It's the lowest rate paid by any of the residents of a neighborhood south of the Ship Canal. It's South Lake Union and the Westlake neighborhood, essentially Paul Allentown. You can't tell me that it is fair to charge $2.50 for parking in the International District and charge $1.25 in South Lake Union. That is not fair. And it's really not fair to charge $4 to raise the parking rates to $4 in First Hill and $3.50 in Pioneer Square while giving Paul Allen and biotech employers a break in South Lake Union. That's not fair.
I didn't realize that.
I know. Well, few people look at the details.
And it hasn't been like they've been trumpeted in local media.
No. Local media has largely been reprinting the concerns of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce that doesn't want a $4 parking rate downtown.
Like the Seattle Times, which has large property holdings in South Lake Union.
You think they would care? Yeah. But apparently.
No, they do care.
They don't want people to know about that.
All right. All right, moving along. Proposal in the Washington State Legislature about a new banking system?
Yes, there were bills that have been introduced in both the House and Senate of the state legislature calling for a new state bank to be set up. Currently, the state of Washington keeps its cash deposits with Bank of America, which can then turn the money around and use it for to increase their profits. The legislators and activists in the state of Washington want that to change. They want Washington to set up what would be called the Washington Investment Trust, essentially a publicly owned bank that would take the state's cash deposits and be able to use those to make loans within the state of Washington to help communities here at home instead of depositing them with essentially an international conglomerate that will use the money where they see fit and pay huge bonuses to their upper management and large dividends to their shareholders. The way a public bank would function is that you would essentially cut out the shareholder and you would not be paying huge bonuses to upper management. The upper management would be public employees whose salaries would be reviewed by the legislature and et cetera. Now, I'm all for this. I think this is a really good idea. On the other hand, because there's the risk that this bank, of course, to make money, you don't just hold cash and make money that way. You have to use the cash by loaning it out and getting interest back on those loans. There's the risk that some of that money might go into very risky loans, or the bank might engage in some of the risky investments that Wall Street banks have done. So there's a little bit of caution that has to be written into the bills, or has to be a part of any legislation that sets up a public bank. There has to be good oversight, and you have to be careful who you hire as upper management and what their training and what their inclinations are in terms of how that money is going to be used.
Yeah, the best analogy for this, if you look at the movement of cooperative groceries over the years, some of them do very, very wonderful work and are very community-based and help organic growers and so forth. And then you've got some that are basically run by people who have spent their entire careers working for Safeway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same thing here. If you're hiring people from, say, Washington Mutual or Bank of America to run and oversee a Washington State bank, then you're going to get the same policies and you don't really have any net improvement, even though it's publicly owned.
Yeah, there has to be very clear policies in place for how that money is going to be used so that it does return so it does make a reasonable rate of return that is then paid back to the taxpayers and helps to balance the state budget, but at the same time avoids significant risk that could put the taxpayers' money, you know, in jeopardy, or put the Washington Investment Trust, the public bank itself, into deep debt.
All right. Anything else on that?
No. Let's move on.
All right. Well, I was surprised to hear on Counterspin they talked briefly about the bomb found in Spokane.
They're about a week behind the news. They're talking about the immediate news coverage of it and how it wasn't particularly a national story because the bomb didn't go off. Whereas you know that if the suspects of the bomb had been Islamic militants, we'd currently be making it mandatory that you screen people before they go to public parades and that sort of thing. Very little coverage this week outside Spokane itself for the latest development in the investigation into the bomb that was placed in the route of the Martin Luther King Jr. parade in Spokane a couple of Mondays ago. That is that the bomb included a chemical component that thought to be heparin or some kind of anticoagulant that would make civilian casualties worse because people would tend to bleed more heavily. This is the sort of thing that in theory you could find it on the internet, but in practice, it's very likely that this person has experience either in the Middle East or in some sort of military capacity, whoever was responsible for this bomb. The FBI is being very tight-lipped about possible suspects, but we know that there's been very little questioning of, white supremacists and right-wing groups in, Northeast Washington and Northern Idaho. And, one has to wonder, again, given that there was a bombing attempted bombing last March also at the federal building in Spokane with a similar, although less lethal bomb, whether it's going to take more of these bombs before investigators start to get a handle on who's doing this and before the news media starts taking these stories seriously.
All right.
And before people start actually calling it what it is, which is terrorism.
Moving on, a couple updates in regards to Washington State and marijuana.
Yeah, first, talking about Olympia again, Mary Lou Dickerson, a representative from Seattle, introduced a bill in Olympia this week that would entirely decriminalize marijuana. That bill is not expected to go very far, particularly because even if you get reluctant legislators to sign off on a bill like that, it seems unlikely that Governor Gregoire would actually sign it into law. However, also at the same time, Sensible Washington, which attempted to file 1068 last summer, trying to decriminalize marijuana by getting that on the ballot as an initiative last year. They failed in an attempt to get that on the ballot because they didn't have enough money to collect enough signatures. But this year, with more volunteers and a full year to have done fundraising, they have once again filed an initiative and are going to attempt to put it on the ballot this year. They've also changed the initiative somewhat from last year in that the language of the initiative this time actually requires that the legislature as part of the passage of the initiative, if it passes, formulate some sort of a distribution mechanism through the state liquor store system. So it does provide for some sort of distribution mechanism for marijuana if it becomes decriminalized. That was one of the major criticisms of the initiative last year, initiative sponsors were saying that they, because of the Tim Iman rule, you couldn't have two different subjects, within the same initiative and therefore they couldn't tackle the distribution question. Well, they're trying to do that this time and hopefully that will be able to pass court muster if and when it gets challenged after passage. So expect to see that on the ballot this year because I don't think they're going to have too much trouble getting the signatures necessary to put it on the ballot.
Yeah, and I think there was a poll this week, too, that said a slim majority of Washington residents support the legalization of marijuana. So if they do get the initiative going, it will be interesting to see what it does in the polls.
All right. Moving on, we have local elections coming up later this year, both for city races as well as Congress. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And
no, just for city races. Congress is in 2012.
Oh, okay. So, Dave,
we got some early candidates declaring.
Yeah,
we?
Well, these days, when you're running for Congress, you pretty much have to start running immediately after the last election. It's a continuous cycle at this point. And we got an announcement this week of somebody who's looking to challenge Dave Reichert in 2012. That being Representative Roger Goodman, a Democrat from the 45th District in Kirkland. He incidentally is one of the co-sponsors of the Mary Lou Dickerson bill to decriminalize marijuana. He's announced he'll run against Reichert in 2012. 2012. Now, there are a couple of wrinkles to that. One is that he right now does not actually live in Reichert's district. He lives in Jay Inslee's district, and Inslee is widely expected to run for governor in 2012. But as a fellow Democrat, Goodman probably doesn't want to announce for that seat immediately. So it may well be that Goodman is getting a campaign up and going, and then if Inslee jumps into the governor's race, creating an open seat in the first district, which is South Snohomish County and far northern King County, then Goodman would jump into that race instead. The other question about this, however, is that between now and the 2012 election, there's going to be redistricting on the basis of the 2010 census. So from that standpoint, Goodman could find his residence either in the first district, in Reichert's 8th district, or in the newly created 10th district that'll be created by the districting commission because of Washington's population growth over the last 10 years, or Goodman could choose to move into one of those districts. So it's not entirely clear who he's running for, but as Goodman himself said, right now it makes the most sense to run against Reichert. He's considered vulnerable. He's narrowly won re-election each of the times he's been up for election over the last several cycles, and he is also thought to be thinking either of retiring or himself possibly running for other office in 2012. So that's sort of positioning already going on for the 2012 election.
All right. Moving on to national and this last Tuesday's State of the Union address.
Yes, indeed. I always am interested in the State of Union address given by the president, because it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the year and what at least the president, and in this case the party that controls the Senate, are thinking of as the major issues to be worked on. And this time around, I just cringed, I have to tell you. I want to quote one line from the State of the Union address. Quote, "At stake is whether new jobs and industries take root in this country or somewhere else," end quote. When he got to that point, I just thought, well, no.
Where's the laugh track?
I just thought, well, no, not really. That is not really what's at stake at all. I was just kind of scratching my head going, okay, now that the economic downturn has gone on for a good 3 years, we're heading into the fourth year, it's time to roll out the fear of foreigners at this point, because really nothing else is working, and the Democrats and Obama can't talk about what the real issues are and what the real causes of the problems are. What's really at stake is that we've gone through a massive redistribution of wealth from the middle and lower classes up to a very small number of people who sit on top of the economy, making fat profits now while everyone else is continuing to suffer. And what I found really interesting is that he couldn't talk about the real reason why we have a jobless recovery. It's not because our education standards are lagging. It's not because we haven't shifted to a green economy yet. It's because U.S. corporations are squeezing more and more hours out of fewer and fewer workers. And again, the guys sitting at the top, the major shareholders and the CEOs, are making big bucks because the people down below them are working harder than ever while a lot of their colleagues were laid off. And in fact, Obama actually says it in the State of the Union address. He says, and this is a direct quote, "No workers are more productive than ours." And that's exactly right. That issue of productivity may seem like a good word. It's a good word if you're a manager. If you're a worker who is putting in 10, 12, 14-hour days, if you're working 50, 60-hour weeks, it's not such a good thing. And it's really not a good thing if you were laid off.
This reminds me of a story, I think it was in the New York Times yesterday, talking about how carpooling rates have fallen dramatically over the last 30 years. And it didn't get until after the jump on the second page that they got to what I think is probably the major reason why, which is nobody works 9 to 5 anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't keep regular hours. If you can't keep predictable hours, how can you have a carpool?
Yeah, how can you get a bunch of people together to go into work at the same time if some of them have to get up at 6 in the morning because they're working 10 or 11 hour days, you know. I just it just doesn't you know, just doesn't seem to be leaking through into the mainstream media, much less into the rhetoric of politicians, that this is a major problem. So I think, so this idea that we have to lower our trade deficit and close our borders and beat the Chinese at clean energy, I think that's just crazy. You know, first of all, you know, we have always had trade deficits. And we probably always will. Trade deficit is just a balance in the flow of goods and services around the world. It really has nothing to do with the economy. I mean, we had a trade deficit when we were going through boom times as well as now. So out-competing other countries, really, that doesn't really make any sense to me, especially when you talk about clean energy. I mean, that's a race that we're just getting started on, when the Chinese are almost already to the finish line in terms of wind power, in terms of solar power, et cetera. The fact that he's using that is a smokescreen, just doesn't want to talk about what's really the issue here.
Something completely different jumped out at me from his speech, and that that is absolutely true also.
Yeah.
But what really jumped out at me, aside from, you know, the new phrase "win the future," which you know, I don't know which presidential brain trust came up with that slogan,
but it kind of
reminds me of Committee to Reelect the President. Nobody was really thinking of the acronym WTF, but in the meantime, we're going to invest in the future. And we're going to freeze domestic spending. Tell me again how that works.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me very much of the old Reagan claim that we're going to cut taxes, we're going to boost military spending, and we're going to balance the budget. You know, all by themselves, perhaps laudable goals, but mutually contradictory goals.
Yes.
And part of the essence of politics is having to make tough choices amongst competing goals, all of which have something going for them. Again, here, you have, you know, yes, you want to invest in the future. Well, how do you invest in the future? Well, you spend on education. Well, you can't do that when you're cutting taxes for the wealthy, and when at every level, federal, state, and local, you're getting huge budget cutbacks on money invested in education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know that with the Republicans controlling the House, there's not going to be more money forthcoming for that. So, you know, it seemed mostly like empty rhetoric to me.
Oh, yeah.
And empty rhetoric designed basically to appeal to everybody and to poll well. And indeed, you know, polls show that most people thought very highly of the speech. It said all the right things. And I feel kind of like a Grinch for saying, you know, no, the pretty words really aren't enough at this point. You have to start acknowledging reality and saying, what kind of steps can we take to deal with that reality instead of what will poll well?
Yeah, and this is not a plan going forward. I mean, this speech, I was looking at it going, okay, where's the plan in here? There's no plan, you know? It, just as Jobs said, it really does not reflect the reality, this idea that we're going to invest in education, that we're going to rebuild infrastructure. Those are all great goals. There's no money for it. There are ways to get that money, but he didn't talk about them. He didn't talk about repealing the Bush-era tax cuts. He didn't talk about cracking down on corporate tax loopholes like corporations who have a lot of their cash in offshore accounts and don't pay taxes on their income from their foreign ventures. He didn't talk about corporations who employ contractors long-term because they don't want to contribute money to Medicare and Social Security. He didn't talk about any of those things. And those are all things that would help reach those very laudable goals. So, again, as Jobs said, it's, you know, it was a lot of hot air, and it's not a plan going forward.
All right. Well, moving on to international and situation in Egypt.
Yeah, well, not just Egypt, but all across the Middle East, because even though it's not getting as much attention, there have also been major demonstrations, which by itself is, you know, hugely unprecedented in Jordan, in Yemen, even in Syria, spreading from the original revolution in Tunisia 2 weeks ago. But the one that's really been notable over the past several days is in Egypt, and even today on Saturday, massive demonstrations in Cairo, Alexandria, Suez. If you're wanting to follow this, by the way, Al Jazeera, by far the best media source for following what's going on in Egypt, as opposed to the American media, where they're basically interviewing American experts who know nothing about Egypt or the Middle East,
yeah,
and are talking all about, well, what does this mean for America? When in fact, you know, one of the many truths about this is that what happens in Egypt is not dependent on anything that the United States does. We have really no control over what happens there right now. now.
And it's not fitting into the usual categories. It's not a bunch of radical Muslim fundamentalists who are leading the demonstrations, so the Western media doesn't know how to talk about it.
Yeah, it's primarily originally secular youth earlier in this week, but at this point it's a broad cross-section of Egyptian society that's coming into the streets. The army is the big wild card in this, because the Egyptian army, of course, staffed through conscripts, and a lot of those conscripts have been consorting with the demonstrators in the streets of Cairo and Alexandria. But the real question is how the leadership of the Egyptian military responds to this, and whether they try and force Mubarak out or whether they are loyal to him. Expect Mubarak to try to hang on, and you're really looking at this point, okay, what is the best historical parallel to this? In kind of the domino effect that we're seeing from the original demonstrations in Tunisia, it's somewhat reminiscent of 1989 in Eastern Europe and all the various communist regimes. But at the same time, you could see a couple of other possible parallels, and certainly with 1989 in Tiananmen Square, where the repressive government eventually cracks down and does hang on to power. That's certainly a very possible outcome in Egypt right now. You would have a hard time seeing how the government could continue to govern. But what we're seeing right now with Mubarak firing his cabinet last night, naming a new vice president today, those are moves that are aimed not at the Egyptian population, which is going to find nothing short of Mubarak's resignation to be an acceptable outcome to this. They're aimed at appeasing the international community, so that if a crackdown comes, or when a crackdown comes, it mitigates some of the damage. They can say, well, we listen to the legitimate demonstrators. Now these are simply hooligans out of control, and we have to restore order. That kind of an ominous setup could be what's happening, and that sort of thing also what happened in Tehran a couple of years ago. Bear in mind also that just because the Islamists are not part of the instigators of the demonstrations right now, that does not mean that if Mubarak resigns and there's a power vacuum in Egypt, that they would not wind up coming to power, because there are really very few organized civil institutions in Egypt that have been able to compete with Mubarak over the years. And the church and the Muslim Brotherhood is really the only one. So that there are very few other centers of power that could step in to take control of the country if the Mubarak regime falls. So there's a lot of different balls in the air here, a lot of implications for U.S. and Israeli and Israel-Palestine policy, of course, because Egypt also has a border with Gaza, and the United States basically has controlled Egyptian policy regarding Israel-Palestine over the last 30 years. That could change radically. Yeah. And we could see a lot of changes in the Middle East as a result of this. First and foremost, for the people of the Middle East themselves, who've been living under U.S.-supported dictatorships for the last couple generations.
That's what I find very interesting about this, is here we have the Bush administration fantasy coming true, the Bush administration's fantasy that democracy would be brought to the Middle East, but not in the countries that they had in mind for it. So not in places like Iran and Iraq, but instead in the dictatorships that we supported and that the U.S. has always been happy to support, places like Tunisia and like Egypt. I find that very interesting.
And even though the demonstrations are not about the U.S. in particular, don't forget that anybody's going to overlook the fact that the tear gas casings and the bullet casings left on the streets of Cairo as the police have tried to crack down on these demonstrators all have Made in the USA stamped on them, because that's where most of our aid to Egypt goes, is into the security forces.
Exactly.
All right. Unfortunately, that doesn't really leave us much time for anything else. Can you briefly touch upon the airport bombing in Moscow, or you want to?
Yeah, well, just very briefly, that at least 35 people killed on Monday at a bombing in Moscow, and the source of that bomb was a suicide bomber who walked up to the security checkpoint. Very similar to what's happened in the Middle East, and it's only a matter of time before somebody tries something like that in Europe or Western Europe or the United States.
All right, and events.
Yeah, we have coming up today as a response to what's going on in Egypt. We've seen solidarity demonstrations around the world, and there's going to be one here in Seattle today from noon until 3 o'clock at Westlake. So I think some of the Egyptian expat community will be there, and other people wanting to support the people of Egypt. Noon, Westlake Park today, Seattle, be there.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is the website. And opinions, news, commentary, comics, all kinds of good stuff. Check it out, www.eatthestate.org. And if you'd like to contribute material to us, you're certainly welcome to. Drop us a line at editorial@eatthestate.org.